From the KGOU studios, I'm Suzette Gorlot, the Dean of the University of Oklahoma's College of International Studies. Welcome to Worldviews. Earlier this week, a six-month deal was reached to curb Iran's nuclear program in exchange for a reduction in economic sanctions. Rebecca Cruz joins me to talk about the reaction among Saudis, Israelis, Americans, and Europeans.
Perhaps some security concerns there, but also a little bit of a power struggle concern that Iran is able to kind of wield power in the region and is now dealing with the United States.
And later, I'll talk with Oklahoma native Lenelma Johnson. She moved with her family to India in 1971 to serve a school as a tenet of their Baha'i faith.
But whenever the parents or anyone came in through the doors of New Era School, they all knew that everyone was treated equally, you know, with dignity and respect.
Defying India's caste system through education. But now, the news. This is Worldviews. I'm Suzette Gorlot. Rebecca Cruz, big news this week. The United States, Iran, and European partners have negotiated a deal, a nuclear deal, a bit of it done rather secretly. The United States and Iran kind of meeting in secret in parallel to this negotiation process that had been going on for some time. But end of the day, they come up with an agreement. It's this huge first time the United States and Iran have agreed on anything since, of course, the severed relations in 1979. But here's what it does for Iran. It releases billions of dollars of Iranian oil sales that's been held in frozen accounts for many years, ends restrictions on Iran's ability to engage in trade, so trading gold, chemicals, car parts, machinery, various things. So it really does relax a lot of the economic sanctions that Iran has been suffering from. And in exchange, Iran has agreed to stop enriching uranium and that they'll reduce stocks of already enriched uranium. They'll stop building this reactor that they're currently working on, a new reactor that produces plutonium, which is higher bomb grade material. They're going to kind of slow down their capacity or freeze their capacity to continue to enrich uranium. And they're going to open up their entire nuclear process, their facilities, to International Atomic Energy Agency inspection. So it's a big deal. I mean, a lot of people are like, this is pretty big, both for Iran in terms of the reduction in the sanctions and for the rest of the world that have been concerned about the Iranian program. But yet, you know, so what's the reaction, I guess? What's the reaction around the world? What have you been watching on this issue?
Well, as you mentioned, it is a very big deal that the fact that the United States and Iran even were at the table together was a big deal. That this came out of the P5 plus one, including Germany, also significant. And again, a big deal. However, it is just a six-month plan. Hopefully, this will lead to further talks and that we can prolong some of this progress here. But yeah, some mixed results around the world. The United States, a recent poll by Reuters came out and said about 44% of Americans are happy about this resolution.
And some people are saying this is a huge foreign policy coup for
the
President
Obama administration, yes.
But yet a lot of Americans are skeptical, right?
Well,
that we shouldn't trust the Iranians so easily and quickly.
Well, and part of that comes from a concern from Israel. We heard, of course, Netanyahu came out and said that this was a huge mistake. And the same poll did point out that Americans are still very much in support of Israel and feel that Tehran is not to be trusted. So kind of a mixed result there. But Israel is concerned. And then Saudi Arabia also showing some signs of concern, perhaps some security concerns there, but also a little bit of a power struggle concern that Iran is able to kind of wield power in the region and is now dealing with the United States. You remember, of course, Saudi Arabia and Israel remain strong U.S. allies.
Well, those are our go-to players in the region, right? Israel and Saudi Arabia. And so they're not only concerned, like you said, about the security, but the fact that the Americans are now talking to the Iranians and that has implications for the power balance in the region. Are we no longer going to be our go-to people? I mean, that's what they're thinking, right? How does this affect us? But it's ironic, right? So you roll back the nuclear capability, which they're not happy about either. And yet, you know, there's some concerns about the diplomatic relationships that might emerge from this situation. But it's diplomacy won the day in this situation, right?
It certainly appears to. And this really is a good news for Iran, as they've been under very heavy sanctions for quite some time. And as you mentioned, some of these will be eased up. I think it's also good news for Germany. I mean, it's somewhat interesting that Germany was added into this discussion. And they're a very big economic partner with Iran, or were before the sanctions. But really, Germany on the world stage, they're not a P5 member. member, but they're being significant in this case.
P5 being permanent members of the Security Council of the United Nations. Well, you know, in Iran, the reaction was, of course, very positive. The negotiators were welcomed back, you know, with cheers and applause and accolades, and, you know, treated as heroes for having negotiated this deal, as temporary as it may or may not be. We'll see. But nonetheless, it seems like the Iranians were ready. I mean, they clearly have been struggling with all of these sanctions. And that's the point, right? Mm-hmm. That's the point of the sanctions, is to bring them to the table and force them to an agreement.
Well, and I think with the new president, we were hopeful of this. I think we still remain somewhat hesitant. We want to see exactly where all of this is going to go. But the fact that the President Rouhani in power now for about 5 to 6 months, that we are having these talks with him, I think this is a positive sign.
Well, I guess we'll watch and see what happens. But nonetheless, big foreign policy deal this week with Iran. So thank you, Rebecca, as always, for your insight and analysis.
Thank you.
We'd love to hear your thoughts about the show and answer any questions you may have. You can follow the program on Twitter at WorldviewsKGOU, or each of us individually at Suzette Gorlott and at Cruz226. You can also leave comments on our website, KGOU.org. In a few minutes, I'll talk with Oklahoma native Lanelma Johnson. She spent 12 years serving a school in rural India and wrote a book about her family's experiences called Oki and Asari. I'm Suzette Gorlott, and this is Worldviews. This is Worldviews. I'm Suzette Gorlott. 45 years ago, Lanelma Johnson and her husband Ray accepted the Baha'i faith and its tenet to serve humanity and the oneness of mankind. That desire took her and her family to India in 1971, where they taught children ages 5 to 18 at a small rural school in Panchgani. She's written a book about the 12 years she spent leading the new era school called Oki and Asari. Lanelma Johnson, welcome to Worldviews.
Thank you. It's nice to be here.
So you have written this very interesting book about your 12 years that you lived in India. How did you pick this school and this country? Just by searching? What is it that drew you? Was there something that spoke to you about India? Had you visited? I mean, that's a huge move, taking three small children and your entire family and uprooting and traveling, you know, the other side of the planet. So, I mean, what was it that spoke to you about that particular place and location and that time?
My husband's dean, Dr. Dwight Allen, who is a very well-known international educator as well as in the United States, actually told us about this small school because he had just visited there in 1970. And he suggested that we check it out. And it was owned by the school was owned by the National Spiritual Assembly of the Baha'is of India. So we contacted them and we were invited to come and visit. So first Ray went to a visit, and then a few months later I went to visit. And we decided, we were just drawn to the school, I think, mostly because of the children.
And what was it about them that you felt like they needed you? They needed your education? What was it that you were going to provide them?
Well, this was a boarding school. And children were there from ages 5 through high school. And they were far from home. And some of the children were there because they were orphans. And some were there because they came from war-torn countries. And we really felt like that we could do a service there for these children. So that was basically the reason that we wanted to go there. And we did just fall in love with India and the children right away.
So what was your experience with the educational system in particular? Because there have been a lot of concerns over the years about the Indian education system and equal access and questions of, you know, lack of equity across the country in terms of the educational opportunities that are provided to children. So what was it that you saw and experienced, and how, you know, did your work contribute to any kind of solution?
Well, I think it did, because we did have Indian children from the village where the school was located, Panchgani, India. The male children were of the majority when we arrived, and in the boarding school also, the male children were the majority when they were coming to be in the boarding from other parts of India. So we set us about to really consciously recruit female children from all over India to be, and also from the village, to be day students. And so that issue was definitely there. Female children were not given the opportunities that male children were given. We did have a short example on what happened. This has to do with the caste system. It's changing the subject a bit. But we had a sweeper in our school who cleaned the toilets every morning, and she was the lowest caste, the Harijan caste. She had a small daughter who worked with her who was about 10 years old. And we decided if we could get that little girl to come to our school on a scholarship, she might be able to break out of her caste system if she were educated. So the mother did agree, and that little girl started to school. She continued to do her work in the school before school started in the mornings, but that little girl went on to become the very first Harijan to work for Air India. And she became an air hostess when she finished her school.
My guest is Lanelma Johnson, who chronicled the 12 years she spent working at a school in rural India in her book, Oki and Asari. Let's take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. I'm Suzette Guerlat, and this is Worldviews. You're listening to Worldviews. I'm Suzette Guerlat, the Dean of the University of Oklahoma's College of International Studies. I'm speaking with Lanelma Johnson, who worked and taught at a school in rural India during the 1970s, and wrote about her experiences in a book called Oki and Asari. When we left off, she described how they actively recruited female students to give them opportunities typically reserved for boys. Yeah. But you raised two important issues here that I'd like to ask you about, and that is gender equity in schooling, but also in general in India, but also the caste system and the socioeconomic discrimination that exists. Over your time there, how did you see that evolve or change, if at all? I mean, did you see India kind of working to the point where these were less relevant or less concerning, or did you really not see much change during your time there?
You know, in India, we say some things never change and some things always change. yes, I think we did see change in that area. Later, of course, now the caste system is illegal, but sometimes in some places it does still exist. But I think that in our school particularly, we didn't have that situation. In fact, because of ignorance and lack of understanding of the culture, when we first arrived, we were only 31 years old, and we made a lot of mistakes, and the local people were very forgiving. But we did have a gathering of our local day parents in our school to introduce ourselves when we first arrived. We were first Americans in that village. And they all came into the school. There were about 40 parents, and more than that if both these parents came, maybe 60 people. And they were all seated side by side. We didn't know who was what religion, who was what caste, and they were served tea and snacks. And at the end of that gathering, the man that was translating for Ray came and said, "Sir, there's been a miracle here today." And he said, "What miracle was that?" And he said, "The Harijans were sitting next, the lowest caste was sitting next to Brahmins, the highest caste, and next to Hindus and Muslims and Buddhists. And they would never do that in our community outside. But whenever the parents or anyone came in through the doors of or gates of New Era School. They all knew that everyone was treated equally, you know, with dignity and respect. So the word quickly spread throughout the village. So in our small community, we did see a big difference as the years went by, particularly in our school with the children.
And so this is largely related, I guess, to education, right? With education, with, you know, greater opportunity comes a more open mind and an ability to overcome these kinds of differences.
I think so, because it's through tradition and ignorance, really, and lack of education and understanding, that with the education and the children in our school were growing up side to side, and they didn't know. They didn't even realize their best friend might be of a different caste, or all the children were treated the same, no matter what faith they were. This school was owned by the Baha'i faith, but we were open to all faiths. And so I think through the educational system, when they left there, if they could break out of a caste system. And that's what's happened in India. I think that, you know, many people have come out of there. If it's a low caste, they've been educated and they've been able to go on and break out of that and improve their lives.
So think about India today. I mean, how connected are you still to India today? I mean, are you up to date on kind of what's going on in the news? Because India has been in the news lately for things that aren't really all that pleasant. So violence against women, for example, let's go back to this issue of girls and their access to education. I mean, there's a tremendous amount of discrimination and violence still against women today. Are these things that, you know, your approach in one little village really needs just to be, you know, to grow across
yes.
India in order to address these kinds of problems?
Well, to answer your first question, we're very connected still to India. We've been back to India many times, and we are so connected with the students that were with us during those 12 years that, you know, we travel the world, we see our students and so forth. And also our son, Craig Johnson, who was 5 years old when we went to India. After 20 years, he's been with the American school system, first of all, for 18 years. But 3 years ago, he went back to India. He is a superintendent of the American School of Bombay. So, yes, we're very connected. We were there just a year and a half ago. To answer your second question about the female students and those issues that are you know, happening today. I actually feel safer in Bombay, Mumbai, and parts of India that I do than I do in the United States, in some cities, in some areas. The issue of the young girls and prostitutions or whatever they're taken for, that happens everywhere in the world. And I think when those incidents happen, it is there, and it's a terrible issue, and I think they're working on that. But the population of India is so great, and the poverty issue is so great that it I don't know when it will be resolved. But the people of India are absolutely wonderful, and the culture is wonderful, and I think, you know, things have greatly improved for females.
So this is a negative perception that we perhaps see played out in the media and other parts of the world that doesn't necessarily match up in real life in India, in the sense that, you know, as you mentioned, these things happen everywhere. It's not just India. It's not just poor countries. It's not just those who struggle, but in all parts of the world. And so is it a matter of kind of how it plays out and how we learn about these parts of the world? That's really the problem. And it goes back to this issue of education, educating ourselves. I mean, are we ourselves ignorant of what life is like in India?
I think so. The typical Indian youth or child would know much more about geography and what's happening in the world than an American child or youth would know, for example. And I think if people would travel and investigate more about what's happening in the world, they would find out that, you know, things have improved. For example, the Dharavi slum in Mumbai, where Slumdog Millionaire was filmed. Everyone's familiar with that. We took a tour of that slum, which is a city of a million people. A year and a half ago, we went there, and we saw amazingly wonderful things that were happening there. People have lived there for several generations, and it grew from a small slum to a large slum. It's still called slum, but they have schools, they have churches, they have synagogues and temples and mosques and hospitals. And we met children with school uniforms on, clean, speaking English, going to school. We saw so many cottage industries with arts and bread being made that was being sent to Taj Mahal Hotel, which is a 5-star hotel. And we came away with a feeling that this is a community. These people actually feel safe here. And even if they had the funds to rent something in the city of Mumbai, they probably wouldn't leave. It's very interesting.
Well, I think you've definitely told us exactly what we all should know, and that is we need to see these things firsthand in order to truly understand them. So thank you so much, Lynelma, for joining us today and sharing your story.
Thank you for your invitation. I appreciate it.
You've been listening to my conversation with Lynelma Johnson, who spent 12 years teaching students in rural India. You can find more information about her book, Oki and Asari, and see a slideshow of photos from the school and the village on our website, kgou.org. Worldviews is produced by the University of Oklahoma's College of International Studies through a collaborative partnership with KGOU. Brian Hardzinski edits the show and writes all of the content for our website, and Hillary Gibson prepares the research for our interviews. For Rebecca Cruz, I'm Suzette Gralat.